Welcome to McGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can check out our website, themcguffinman.com, to keep up with, or I suppose listen to, our previous 303 episodes. We most recently talked about Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Before that was And Justice for All, starring Al Pacino. Before that, Double Indemnity.
Woo!
And before that was Poltergeist. I've also written a handful of things recently. I wrote something about Blade Runner 2049 a couple weeks ago.
Woo!
The rare, we already podcasted about it, and yet I still feel compelled to write about it sort of situation. And Nathan For You. And I also wrote something about more the reception of Lady Bird than Lady Bird itself. I think there's only like one sentence actually about Lady Bird in there. But yeah, you can check those out, themcguffinman.com. All right, theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
James.
Yes. Do you think they still need to listen to the episodes after my brief?
I mean, you're so excited about all of them that I'm sure every listener paused this immediately after the intro, went and listened to all four of the podcasts, canceled all their plans, stayed up very late listening to our podcast, and now they're back. So thank you for returning, fair listener.
Welcome back, guys. Yeah.
And now you're in for a bit of a bummer because we're talking about Last Action Hero.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if this movie's trying to be anything, it's fun, right?
I mean, yes. It's also trying to be so many things, but... But yes, I would say fun is number one of the version that exists. You know? I feel like
right. The
original version of this movie, its number one goal was not fun. But then,
yeah.
Then the mass marketing of the 1990s came around.
I mean, we can start there. There was kind of a pretty long story about how this movie ended up being what it was, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a spec script written by Zach Penn and Adam Laff, who basically like pranked their way into finding an agent, which is a fun story that people can read. I think their agent's name was Chris Moore. He ended up becoming a producer. And then this script got sent around studios and it became like a hot property. And the character, I think originally Slater was originally called Arno Slater as opposed to Jack Slater. Like he was so clearly based on Arnold Schwarzenegger. And they didn't try and hide that at all. And so, like, they were just in disbelief when it's actually started to attract a major studio because it is a very weird script and a very weird concept, especially for the early 90s. And then probably got even more excited when Arnold Schwarzenegger became attached to it. And it's a notable movie in Arnold Schwarzenegger's career because it's his first movie as a producer. And he took a lot of creative control over the movie as well.
Yeah, even without knowing the backup story to this and how they were kind of shooting a little bit lower. I mean, as you said, it's such a weird script and it is very odd that it ends up being Arnold. And that's what I was thinking about watching it. Like, this movie could be done with just a, you know, C to B list good looking actor, right? Like, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. The fact that it is really unusual.
Yeah, absolutely. It's cool that Arnold Schwarzenegger wanted to do this movie at all. I read a little bit of the original script because the original script is easy to find. I don't know that this movie is necessarily great if they go with the original script and it's still Arnold Schwarzenegger attached and all that, because I also don't think there's a lot in Zach Penn or Adam Laff's career to make us think that the movie as a whole would have turned out all that great. But I don't know. I think it would have been a more interesting swing if they really stuck to the idea of, the thing in this movie that I found really interesting is the brief moments when we get Slater started to express doubt about his own life. And those were the moments that I found really interesting and the moments that comment on how violence affects people. And I never expected that it would actually take a turn going all the way into calm discussion about the meaning of violence and how that affects people. But it shows glimpses of it. And like that is where I wanted the movie to go, and I thought that could have that would have been a really interesting place to go. But I never for a second thought it would actually do it, you know. But that is where the real like this movie could have been good part of it lies, you know. Like it's a satire about action movies that ends up being about how if these movies were real, people's lives are destroyed, you know.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean that is it's there a little bit, as you said, and that is kind of some of the jokes, or I mean, some of the most central jokes of this movie are kind of built around that. But yeah, there's never much of an examination of what violent films are doing to audiences or culture, right? Like, did you want it to be a bit more serious like that, or just kind of play with those jokes, or where did what's the like? It sounds like for you, it's just a couple steps away from what you want it to be. What direction do we move in to get this closer to what you would have wanted?
I think just that more playing on the difference between reality and action movies. I don't necessarily mean it needs to be. I think it could have been like funny the whole way through while also making jokes about these things. I mean, Shane Black is also a credited writer on this movie. I think he's the perfect example of somebody who is able to make movies that I think are very thoughtful and about serious ideas, but the jokes never stop. And I think that I wish that this idea had come from Shane Black, basically, so that he could have had a little bit more control over it. Although, I mean, The Last Boy Scout was around the same time, and that was a movie that got kind of chopped to bits as well, despite the fact that it ended up being pretty good. He hates it. So I don't know. It's hard to talk about because this movie's so bizarre. But I don't think would have wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger sitting down and saying, hey, kids, this is what violence does to people. But I will say that the moment in this movie that I found the most interesting is when Benedict sees the villain, when he's in the real world and he sees somebody get their shoes taken from them, and he doesn't hear screams or sirens or whatever. And then he just immediately just walks up to somebody and murders them, yelling that he did it, you know, and somebody yells back, shut up. Just that idea of the disconnect between in the real world, villains can win, you know, like I think that sort of got played with. And in the real world, heroes are just entirely different, you know.
Yeah. OK, so there's a few things I want to touch on there. First of all, the Shane Black thing is funny that he ended up, you know, going over the script himself, because I saw it mentioned in the context that. You know, how different this movie ended up being from what it originally was and the intentions of the screenwriters, Zach Penn and Adam Leff, that they were trying to make fun of those kinds of movies, and that it ends up that, you know, he gets to, you know, Shane Black gets to go over it by the time, before it hits the screen. And yeah, I'm with you. Like, he's someone who's in on the joke, you know. He's someone, like, if especially the more recent movies, but even going kind of far back to this time, like, he's well aware of the ridiculous nature of what he's writing.
I mean, continue.
No, he's just someone who does the action thing well, but always does it, well, not always, but largely does it tongue-in-cheek, and as you said, like, can make an action movie funny and silly while still making it an engaging action movie in the ways that we want our action movies to engage us. So to me, that just isn't the best example of this getting so off the rails. You know, this is so in his wheelhouse that it's not crazy. And I can see why you would look at his movies and want to point to those as ridiculous, because they are, and he knows that. And they were just so popular around the time. So they have to be the fodder for what you're going to do if you're going to spoof it. Not that this movie is a complete spoof, but there's gigantic elements in there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Shane Black, the screenplay that put him on the map is Lethal Weapon, which does a great job of, I mean, the best thing about that movie that everybody forgets is that Riggs is totally suicidal at the beginning of the movie. Like the first time, or I suppose we get an action sequence introduction, but then we get him waking up in his weird like beach trailer and contemplating suicide, you know, and just sort of, I think Shane Black
coming close. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Shane Black always, I don't know. There's more of despite the fact that his movies are so unrealistic, there's like one foot in the door of reality, you know, whereas, I think that's the Shane Black touch that people forget about. Just like, I suppose the, I don't know, like people just sort of are like, they're just fun movies about dudes drinking and cracking jokes, you know? And that's all true. There's a lot of alcoholics and there are a lot of jokes in those movies, but
and a lot of dudes.
Yeah, definitely a lot of dudes. But there is always like a couple scenes in there that actually work where the concept of reality is at least braced in some capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've read a lot about this movie in the last couple days, and in everything Shane Black says, it really sounds like this was a job he took for the money. Because again, I think Shane Black is kind of similar to a lot of Shane Black characters in that he sort of has a, well, why not sort of feeling to the world, where he's just like, well, they want to pay me $1 million to drink this bottle of whiskey and write for a month. Sure. Why turn that down? You know? And just looking at the screenplays throughout his career, you can sort of get that vibe that he has never shied away from doing something for money. I feel like this movie gets remembered almost as a Shane Black movie, despite the fact that I feel like in the finished movie, there's very little of what he would have done to it. And also of the stuff that he did, I don't think he would have tried that hard.
Yeah. I feel like he, it's far too silly to be Shane Black. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, not, sure.
He's capable of having fun, but this isn't like, this is so far. Like it is a parody of the stuff that he does. Right. He takes things a little too far. And then this movie runs with things and takes them way too far.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I kind of get that sense too. I don't know that this movie's that well remembered. Like it's,
no, it's not, but like, it's remembered by people like us just because, like, in the way that Heaven's Gate is the all-time example of just like these movies that were are just so expensive and were marketed heavily and
in space, for example.
Yeah, in space months after the movie got released because they couldn't get it working in time or something like that before the movie released. Anyway,
just to clarify, this movie is famously the first one advertised outside of Earth because they put an ad for it on a rocket and shot it into space. But as you said, it did not go very
Which is like an unbelievable story. Like, if you were to make a movie...
And metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. If you were to make a movie about like a satire about like Hollywood going off the rails and putting too much money and no thought into this movie, that would be something that a writer would come up with and be like, no, we can't do this is stupid, you know?
Yeah, no, it's so excessive and, as you said, so poorly thought out. By the time that the movie's out, they haven't figured it out. Like, it's such an unwieldy idea that it's so extreme and you can't do it right. You just can't possibly do it correctly.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, so excessive and so poorly thought out is sort of how I would describe this movie. That said, I loved watching this movie. It is so entertaining. It is definitely too long. And John McTiernan, the director, has talked about like the very compressed post-production schedule. I think they only had 10 weeks of post-production. I think some of which overlapped. I think a lot of which overlapped with the actual production of the movie, because I think it got greenlit in October 1992 with a release date of June 1993. And that's just not enough time to make a movie this big, you know? And the way that McTiernan has described it, he said that, like, the action scenes, basically we cut the tops and tails off the film and then just put them right into the movie. You know, like, there was no time for actual editing. It's basically just like a high-level assembly cut that ended up getting released because that's how little time they had. And it does feel that way. It does feel that way.
Yeah, that's not a lot of time to make a lot of movies.
No, that is true.
Let alone this kind of movie, right? Mm.
Yeah, I will say, like, the thing that I love about this movie that carries through the whole movie is it looks so expensive. Like,
yes,
every set in this movie just looks like it's covered in money. And it's awesome. Like, it's just awesome to watch, like, this type of filmmaking that just doesn't exist, because it's a super expensive movie where things are happening in practical locations. And it's beautifully shot, anamorphic by Dean Semler. And John McTiernan just knows how to move a camera, or at least, you know, this is right before, I think his last really good movie is Die Hard with a Vengeance. So this is just before that. But, like, so frequently I was just sitting there like, this is gorgeous. Like, it's so beautiful, and it just looks so expensive. Like, there are so many extras in that police station. It's unbelievable. Such a huge space just filled with 1,000 people, you know? Like, that would never happen now. So, yeah, it just looks gorgeous. And unsurprisingly, because, again, John McTiernan has directed a lot of really well-made action movies, and Die Hard is his most famous movie. Die Hard is also a gorgeous movie, you know, shot by Yann LeBlanc. That's what I don't know.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, this movie should look great. I mean, I know what you're saying. Part of it is what you're saying is that this guy knows how to make a good-looking movie, and... But I think the point of especially everything that takes place on the other side or within the silver screen there, it's supposed to be comically good looking and comically expensive. Like the fact that all the women are attractive is kind of the point too, right? Like everything in this version of Los Angeles is supposed to be just ridiculously aesthetically pleasing. Like I think that even when they're still in back in New York, I mean, the theater is supposed to look run down and shitty, but it's a beautiful theater. You know what I mean? Like it's just, it's dimly lit and, you know, not well attended, but, it's still just what actually is a nice theater. But then, as we kind of cross that, the membrane into the cinematic universe. Yeah. I mean, it's LA, it's beautiful. Everyone's good looking. All the cars are nice. So yeah, there's the element of just the craftsmanship of making any movie look good as a director with a good eye, but then we're also in this very cartoonish world, and I don't mean that in the Whiskers the Cat way, where things are just, you know, comically beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. And even another thing that really jumped out at me is that funeral on the rooftop. Like, they're on a rooftop shooting that funeral. Yeah, like, it's unbelievable. This is also a part of the, one of the things that really continued through the end of the 90s was either carrying people in the air through cranes or whatnot. You know, I think The Matrix is one of the last movies that really did something like that before people were like, oh, this is way too dangerous. We can't do this anymore when people are like hanging from a crane. But yeah, you're exactly right. It is supposed to look uncommonly beautiful. And that is how I would describe this movie. And that theater is so huge and gorgeous, and I have no idea how it can still operate. I know it's being turned into a Lowe's multiplex pretty soon after this movie ends, but I just don't understand how it can afford to be open when literally two people are attending what seems to be like an 8 p.m. show the first time he's there.
But I will say that there are like two things that come to mind of things that I really like in New York. I mean, outside of that theater, that's just a nice set, though. I don't think there's anything you know, particularly impressive in the filmmaking about that. That's just a nice, not set, but nice, a nice
huge
setting.
Space. Yeah.
But I mean, and I think this moment's supposed to be funnier, but the when they play chicken in New York in the real world, and two cars just run into each other, it's just a really cool shot. And I mean, it has the advantage of subverting your expectations. It's supposed to be, you know, not what you expect to happen, even though they're talking about what's really going to happen. There's just something, even though it's so small and relatively quiet just because of the way that it's set in the frame and everything, it's just a cool shot, you know, and it's not that loud, and there's just something very realistic about it, which is exactly what it's supposed to be. But I think that's done in kind of this understated, captivating way. You know, there's a way that we've seen the ways that you can shoot a car crash, even in what's supposed to be a realistic movie, or not even an action movie, but something like Whiplash or something, where there's a car accident, but you're right in it, and it's so unexpected and so jarring, just because you're right into it and it's so loud. But this one was, you know, you see it coming, and I don't know, there's something I just like about that shot, just down in the corner the way that it is, and I think that looks really good. And another piece of good filmmaking in New York is when he's got the blood on the inside of his respirator mask in the ambulance. That's something I thought I would have seen somewhere else. And this movie, as we said, it is so silly at times, and I do feel that it does lack an emotional punch that it's not going for most of the time, but sometimes when it is, it misses. And I think that's one that I think it works. Like, there's something about that visual that, you know, it's this clear metaphor that this person is human and can bleed. And, you know, is not the immortal character that he is on the other side of the screen. But I think that is just this moment of panic that is expressed very, very well visually, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to the game of chicken that they play in the real world. When we see that in Los Angeles in movie world, you know, we see it up close. But now that we're in New York, we're in Max, or sorry, I don't know why I feel like every 90s kid was called Max. I don't remember what his name actually is in the movie. I know he sucks.
Danny Madigan.
Sure. Whatever. But
so
like,
Max.
Yeah, exactly. So every 90s kid named Max. But no, he, like, we're staying with his perspective because we're in his world now, you know, like, because we, right. The camera stays with him until he starts to run towards the car and then it follows him. And I agree, that is a good shot. The other shot that I like is his first shot once he enters the movie world, where he's lying in the back of the of Slater's car, and he's just sort of on his back and he's looking up, and it's just, you see the edge of the car that he would see because his head is directly against the edge of it, and just palm trees as they're driving by. And it's sort of like, you know, it's not quite turning his life up, turning his perspective upside down, but that's what the movie is doing, has to do now. You know, it's like you are now in this world where everything is just totally different from what you're expecting. And this shot is such an outlier in the movie. It's like go back to an expensive 90s action movie that we've talked about recently. It's like the POV shot in Con Air. It's just like, it's really jarring because it's the only time it happens in the movie. But it's also a beautiful shot and allows you to get your bearings. And then you're just like, oh, I guess Max is in the movie now, you know?
Yeah, no, and it functions perfectly as a transition shot between those worlds, right? Yeah. Like, as you said, the car crash in New York works well because we're very pinned into this one perspective. And when we see the game of chicken in Los Angeles, and this, you know, in the Hollywood world, we kind of have this omniscient editor's view, right? Like, we have the wheels revving, and then we have, like, hands gripping a steering wheel, and we have a shot of the two cars. You know, we're not really tied to any one person's perspective. We very much just have whatever would make this look the most interesting and the most action-packed. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have it different in New York. And I think that shot you're talking about is he's looking up in the towards the sky from the convertible is that transition. Now we're seeing that Max is in this world. So we're pinned to his view kind of for the last time, and then we get into this much more stylized version.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, where, you know, in the world where anything can happen, and you get a good few feet of vertical off getting kicked in the nuts. And an ice cream cone can pierce the human skull now, and all the other things that make that world make no sense.
Yeah, so I found something that was written about this movie a couple years ago that I think really described what I enjoyed about watching this movie, because I don't think I had seen the whole thing before. I know at some point when we lived together, I think we watched like half an hour of it when it was on TV or something. But
And I think so too. And for some reason, Whiskers the Cat has a very like outsized part of my memory of this movie.
Yeah, like Danny DeVito's the second lead in this movie in your head or something. Yeah.
The Kangaroo Jack syndrome, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, because the part I do remember is the stuff leading up to the funeral and the funeral scene. Like, so I think that is the only part that I saw, and Whiskers does make an appearance in that moment, I believe. So so it would make sense that was the part of the movie that we saw together 10 years ago or whatever when we lived together. But so watching this, a lot of it was surprising. When we got to the movie premiere, I was like, my jaw, I don't know if my jaw dropped, but whatever happens in your brain that makes you think your jaw dropped, that happened a lot of times over the course of the scene of the premiere. I couldn't believe it was happening.
When you fell back into the Blank Man extended universe.
Exactly. But like some of the stuff that they did there, I just couldn't believe. But I mean, we have to talk about that for a while, so I'll leave that for now. But anyway, so on the AV Club a couple years ago, and I know I'm going to mispronounce his name, so apologies, but the writer Ignaty Vishnevsky, I don't know. There's a T in there that is very hard for me to say. Anyway, he's a very good writer. I've mentioned his work before, specifically on the Hail Caesar podcast. But here's something he says when he's trying to describe what he likes about the movie. Starting with a quote from Slater. "I ice that guy," says Slater before adding to Kona phrase, which is a line from the movie. "I laugh every goddamn time, but not because the scene successfully satirizes a trope that I, the viewer, am familiar with. I laugh because of a complex interaction of intentionally unreal and parody elements of things I recognize and things that ignore both common sense and physics. The scene activates that part of my brain that wants to figure out order and purpose, that wants to manage reality, and briefly shorts it out, resulting in a big unsuppressed guffaw." And that's like all the things that I love about this movie, that perfectly sums it up. Because the things that I really like about this movie are the things that just come out of nowhere and make no fucking sense at all, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's just weird. I mean, we talked about it, but with the Shane Black stuff, like it is so silly, but it's not quite that silly. And it does feel like there's two or three movies in here, maybe it takes it a bit more editing to have a more consistent tone. And I don't know, like, it sounds like you like the things that are, or you and this writer, and you're agreeing with them, so I'll just continue to say you, mm-hmm. to mean both of you, but like that you like how it doesn't have that consistent tone, that there's so many things going on, and maybe that's what, like, in a way that shouldn't succeed, it does succeed because it's so impossible to really grasp. Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's part of it. And it is also, like, as a viewer, I'm coming, as an semi-informed viewer, I'm coming from a place of knowing that this is a movie built on excess, and that is a type of movie that I'm always fascinated in, you know? Like, I was trying to think of the most, you know, the most current example of something that could be described as, like, our generation's last action hero, and I like the closest thing I could come up with was Batman versus Superman, not from a bomb perspective, but from a financial perspective, but from a filmmaking perspective, where it's just like a just unchecked hubris from start to finish. Yeah. And I think that movie will go down as being our version of last action hero from a quality or sorry, like a weirdness perspective, because that movie, we talked about it on the podcast, is really fucking weird, you know? Like, the first hour of Batman versus Superman is bonkers and makes no sense, and that was the part that I found entertaining, and it also looks really expensive, you know? The things in Last Action Hero that I don't like seem to be more of the William Goldman stuff, let's hire the writer of The Princess Bride to sort of kid this up a little bit, you know? That's sort of the kid entering the magical universe and having his old friend tell him about the joys of living and all that shit, like all that stuff that,
yeah.
I did not care for. I think probably would have worked for me if I was a kid who saw this movie, but as an adult it just bores me to tears, you know? And it's not entertaining. So like, it seems like the stuff, I don't know, like jumping from different tones, and specifically different writers, it seems like at points in this movie, I don't think it's necessarily that. I just think it's the pure unchecked hubris of this movie that really gets me. And I think if anything, the William Goldman stuff is where it feels more like a movie from the 90s, whereas the stuff that I like in this movie is the stuff that feels totally unique in a, I can't believe this happened. I can't believe so much money was put into this, and I can't believe people were like, this is okay to release, you know? Like, all of those things combining are what make this movie for me and lead to that aforementioned unsuppressed guffaw.
Yeah, I think the thing that this movie always will have going forward, like, as I said, I don't think it's remembered well. I don't think people will look back on this as a good movie. I think that, you know, it still has the tag of bomb just because of how excessive it was and how, you know, little money it ended up making. But at least it'll always kind of be in on the joke. Like, mm-hmm. I know that's not of much comfort for the accountants or, yeah, like the executive who have to face the accountants, you know. I get that's not, you know, that doesn't help them out. But, yeah, there seems like there's so many things about the excess that you could chalk up to, like, oh, but that's, they're making fun of the movies that are this excessive, mm-hmm. even though they are being just as, if not more excessive, in their jokes about it, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And as you said, some of the things that don't feel like just a little kid's adventure film, you know, Arnie, the real Arnie, being told not to plug the Planet Hollywood restaurants and stuff. And, you know, all that celebrity stuff, is all that meta stuff is totally up our alley. And I don't know if it is ahead of its time or if this is the 80s action genre had been around long enough that it was just kind of ripe for parody at this point. So maybe we're giving our generation and our mindset a little too much credit to say that it's ahead of its time.
Yeah, I don't. I think calling it ahead of its time would be incorrect. I feel uncomfortable calling any element of Arnold Schwarzenegger ahead of his time. Like, just I just don't feel like I can give him that credit emotionally. But like, as far as I think it's sort of more like a right on schedule sort of thing.
Yeah,
because, you know, a deconstructionist cinema had exist in some level. I mean, The Purple Rose of Cairo, Woody Allen's film from the mid-80s, is something that is cited as being directly the inspiration for this movie. I think that...
Yeah, that came up a lot in research, yeah.
Yeah, Zach Penn and Adam Laff were calling this the reverse Purple Cairo, because in Purple Cairo, a character enters the real world, and the opposite happens here. So, like, it's been done before, you know? Like, and...
Yeah.
But also, the 90s is a decade where... deconstruction first started to become a really big thing in culture, and I think to call it like right on schedule might even short Last Action Hero a little bit, but like, you know, we've got the rise of David Foster Wallace in the 90s, probably the first and last time anybody's compared Last Action Hero and David Foster Wallace. But then, you know, later in the decade, we've also got Charlie Kaufman, Being John Malkovich, comes out in the 90s. And just this willingness to play with form and genre at a level that is accepted popularly. And this is definitely Arnold Schwarzenegger kicking in that door, for sure. And, you know, as I'm explaining it, maybe it is slightly ahead of its time.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, you mentioned the idea that, or the fact that this is Schwarzenegger's first producing credit. And... you know, so, well, I mean, just to put this in the context of the time frame and something else we've talked about a lot and other things, like, what do you do when you've reached what, I mean, at least to this point, is your career high? This is after Terminator 2, right? That's arguably Arnie's best role in movie. I mean, you kind of have to split that over two movies, but I think everyone's decided Terminator 2 is the superior film.
Yes,
and
correct.
I'm not going to disagree with that. And there's, I mean, he's been a very big celebrity for a long time and continues to be one of the most famous, I would guess, living action stars, right? Like, he's got to be up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, living movie stars, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
Internationally as well, right?
I mean, yeah, absolutely.
He's not, I understand, I'm not saying he's the greatest thespian, but as far as, you know, a recognizable person. And so, T2, that's in the past. He's done some things since, but like, that's probably going to be the pinnacle of it. And so what do you do? We've talked about this with other people's careers, like when you can do almost anything, right? And this is a time where the action movie, people are writing blank checks, as we've kind of seen in this movie. And this is what he goes with. And I think it would be such a cool, like if this movie was better and successful in the ways that we feel it's, we've kind of talked about the ways that we feel that it lacks, this would have been such an incredible way to kind of cement his legacy. Like I know it doesn't need cementing, as I was just arguing that he's, you know, still one of the most famous people, but this would have said, like, not only does he know how to make action movies, but he knows exactly what he's doing to make these action movies. He knows exactly how silly it is. He understands his spot in the culture. He's willing to have a, like, to poke some fun at and poke some fun at it and still be kind of confident in what he's doing. And I don't know, like when we talk about this movie and we research about this movie, there's always this idea of like what this movie almost was or what it was originally could have been, or if it didn't come out a week after Jurassic Park, or if they had more time to edit, or, you know, a million different things that, you know, as if ... But I don't know. I just feel like this, it could have been such a home run if he had, like, on so many levels, if he used his credit for this movie and it ended up being, you know, a great action movie and a great comment about action movies and a great comment about action culture. And maybe the thing you were saying about maybe getting a little bit closer to the difference between action movies and reality or cinema and reality. And I know that this could never be done, and I don't think this would have been the thing that made him, or would have made this movie not a bomb or made it, you know, culturally successful. But if the kid died at the end, you know what I mean? Like, if they really drove something home with some emotional impact, because they even say in the movie, in talking about the difference between movies and the real world, like, this kid never dies. Like, the kid won't die. You won't let a kid die. That's part of what this is. And he goes over the edge, and no part of me ever thinks that the kid's going to die. Like, it's just so obvious, right? Mm-hmm. But if he had, I mean, it really would have had some emotional impact and really had this really firm designation between what is real and what's fake. And I know that we're talking about the real world as this action movie, you know, we've got some blurred lines here, but I just think that that would have been such a kind of a gut punch that really would have said something about violence in movies and said something about the difference between, you know, real life and fiction. And I think that I doubt killing the kid makes this a more financially successful movie in Hollywood, but in a way it has to make it a more successful movie in a way, to people like us, maybe.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, there's a way to do it without killing the kid, too. You could just sort of, because this is something I thought about, where I think this movie would be better if the kid came back from the movie world into the real world and maybe did something in the movie world where he sort of starts to get used to being in this world where nothing bad can happen to him. So he's taking, like, extra chances. You know, he's just doing crazy things. No logical child would ever attempt. And then he comes back to the real world and at least, like, tries to do that same thing and injures himself. And it could be like the different, his equivalent of the chicken scene. You know, it's something that's set up in the movie world. And then, like, he breaks his arm or something. You don't have to kill the kid, but you can still play with the idea that things that he got used to in the movie world not existing in the real world. You know, like, that level of safety doesn't exist. And talking about playing between the difference between reality and the movie world, like, what happens with Slater is exactly what happens with Neo in the Matrix. And it's just like, it's somebody being told that the world that they have existed in is not real, and he now gets brought into this world that is the real world, and he has to figure out what the rules of it are and how to operate in it. I mean, the difference in the Matrix is that the real world looks so much different than the simulated world, whereas there's not that big of a difference here. But that is what happens, you know? And there are so many questions about, so many interesting questions about in the Matrix about what makes reality, what we do to ourselves to help construct our own reality. And none of those questions exist in Last Action Hero, because I just don't think that's where Schwarzenegger's heart lies. And I think you're right that this could have been, like, a really cool, you know, chapter in his biography or whatever. Had it ended up being better than it is. I still think it's cool that this is the movie he was like, I will bring this into the world, you know, like, this will be my first movie as a producer. I think that's really cool. I think something he probably learned on this movie as a producer is that sometimes being hands off at certain points in production is wise. I think that's a lesson that a lot of producers have the ability to learn earlier on in their career, like really good producers, whereas somebody who is as famous as Arnold Schwarzenegger by the time he starts producing, is it just able to be like, well, we should do this, and then it's just like, oh yeah, nobody can say no to you. You're Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it's 1993, you know? So I think that's just a lesson he didn't have time to learn on this movie. I think it's a lesson that this movie probably taught him. But anyway, as far as, like, playing with that sort of the Matrix sort of thing, I mean, I don't think Arnold Schwarzenegger found those parts of the script that as the things that really jumped out at him. I think what jumped out at him was the ability to make fun of himself, which he's very good at doing and has always embraced. He's also a funny actor, you know, like, he's very funny in this movie. When he's talking to the kid's mom, and he's like, we talked, I've never just talked to a woman before. It's neat. Like, all this stuff, like, there are so many moments in this movie that are funny exclusively because Arnold Schwarzenegger saying the line. And everybody, like, has sort of accepted that he's a relatively talented comedic actor. And that's what works in this movie. And I think he knows that's his strength. And those were the parts of this movie this script that jumped out at him, you know? And would make him want to do this movie at his highest peak, you know?
Yeah, not so much an examination of the difference, but just the difference between cinema and the real world. But that is just kind of a framework to make some jokes, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
To look too deeply.
Yeah, and also talking about the difference between the cinema and the real world, like, the world that Arnold Schwarzenegger exists in 1992, 1993 is not at, like, any semblance of the real world, especially at a time when there's still so little you know, there's still such a distance between between celebrities and real people. Like, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger doesn't have a Twitter account in 1992 or anything like that. And like, those things are small in the grand scheme of things, but you know, they remove a layer between you and a celebrity, and there's just still so many layers between regular people and celebrity in 1992, 93. So he's very, very in a bubble, you know?
Yeah, and coming off such a huge streaming successes, and it's, I don't know, I've just had, I looked at his career kind of was more of a straight line, just researching this movie than I'd ever really thought about it. And you know, there's this movie which doesn't go well for a lot of the reasons we listed. And as we said, like, this is his first producing credit, so I think that another one of his movies failing to this degree doesn't mean as much as this one, right? Like, this one is probably the most near and dear to his heart that any movie had ever really been up until this point. You know, he wasn't doing small little vanity indie projects or anything. Like, he was making action movies, and this was just one that he really believed in, and it didn't work out.
And apparently you took it pretty hard that it didn't work out, too.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And it's not surprising. And his story is one of just working really, really, really hard and overcoming an accent and a weird name and, like, a weird, you know, so many things that made it unusual that he was going to be, this, like, the famous actor that he became, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is a big bit of adversity. And then he's got a back injury shortly after this, and then Batman and Robin doesn't go well, and there's kind of just this string of failures, and eventually his retirement. And it was just, I just kind of always thought of him as this action constant, and it's really not that case. And I think it's interesting for a movie to be about how you know, you're not invincible just because you're this action hero. It, when you can look at his whole career as it is now, this certainly isn't the last thing that he did, or the last thing people liked, or the last thing, T2 wasn't the last thing people liked, or the last thing that made money for him, or anything, and he didn't just disappear. But it is interesting to see this as the beginning of a pretty big downturn in the center part of his career.
Yeah, absolutely. And but there is also something like True Lies after. I think that was 96. No, that can't have been 96. It must have been slightly earlier. But which is a semi-self-referential movie as well. You know, it's just, I think that's a movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger was like, I want to try this again. This is something that we can still get right, and it's just sort of a safer version. It's less adventurous, you know. And
but it's not straight down the middle either.
Yeah, exactly. And it was still a success, you know. And but yeah, you are right. Like, it, before Last Action Hero, everything Arnold Schwarzenegger made was a success, and then not everything was, you know, like, he was still very successful, and but just not in the way that he in 1992 had become accustomed to.
Yeah. And it's just a very interesting movie for that to happen on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Also, I just feel like we should mention at some point, like with all huge box office bombs, that get remembered more for being a bomb than for being a bad movie, part of the reason they become bombs is because critics start to pour hate on them, you know? And I think that's a big part of what led to this movie's bombing as well. Was just a couple advanced reviews were just very negative. But these movies that bomb are never as bad as those reviews make it sound. You know, Super Mario Brothers is another bomb from the same summer that is not as bad as the reviews sound. It's weird. It's very weird. So is this. And who knows how I would have felt about those movies in 1993 when you know, the weirdness is more off-putting because you're more used to the filmmaking world of 1993, you know?
Yeah.
But these movies are never as bad as the critics say at the time. Yeah.
No, I feel that critics have like a drawer of good burns for movies that when it seems like they have a chance to bust it out, they will. You know what I mean? Like they just have a joke written and they're waiting for the platform.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's easy, like as somebody who has written probably 100 movie reviews in my life, it's easier to write a negative review than it is to write a positive review. It just is. But, and especially there are so many things to pick on in this movie too, you know? So it's just like, I don't know. Anyway. But yeah, I think we should talk a little bit about the summer that this was released into, because it's pretty amazing. I was reading a lot about,
Yeah, it's one of those years, eh?
Yeah, so it was 1993. So this movie, we've danced around it a little bit without really specifically mentioning it. Jurassic Park opened on June 11th, 1993. And then Last Action Hero opened on June 18th, 1993. So just a week between the two. And advance word on Jurassic Park was like pretty, people kind of knew it was going to be a hit, but like if you go back and look at box office grosses for Jurassic Park, it's unbelievable. Like its opening weekend was 50 million plus in 1993, which is unbelievable. I think it's like second weekend was like 40 million plus. Like there was such a small drop off.
And this had a 47% drop off as any indication of what that means. Yeah.
And, by all accounts, the people, making this movie knew that, and I'm including Arnold Schwarzenegger in with that, knew that Jurassic Park was getting good word and that it seemed like it was going to be a huge hit, and they had a chance to maybe push their date back. And this again goes to the unchecked hubris side of things, decided, and Arnold Schwarzenegger apparently was on board with this decision, to not push the date. And pushing this movie 6 weeks would have been hugely helpful for the movie. I'm sure John McTiernan would have used that time to continue editing.
Even if you had edited it, like if it was the movie you wanted also it to that, be, pushing it helps, right?
Yeah. But
let alone that was, he said they were like, it was 4 weeks or something between when he stopped shooting and when this was done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So basically what we're saying is Last Action Hero and Jurassic Park are the E.T. and Blade Runner of 1993. But no, like even if they had that extra 6 weeks, then you're still coming up against The Fugitive in August. Like, it's crazy. And so Super Mario Brothers also came out that summer. Cliffhanger came out that summer, which I believe didn't make money. I think that's notable for being a bomb. Am I right about that? Or am I wrong? That did make money.
I don't have that in that category in my head, but that's not
sure. But either way, Sleepless in Seattle also came out that summer and made a lot of money. So that's just, Nora Ephron. So it's just like that summer is just bonkers, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just found that very interesting.
Yeah. No, it's like they just went in all in on it, and I saw that they said, because it seems like McTiernan was not a big fan of the idea. You know, he would have liked to seen it pushed. He said there's just a series of things that went wrong with this. Now, who knows if this is someone trying to cover their ass after the fact, right? Yep. And judging from John McTiernan's later legal troubles, he looks like someone who makes mistakes and tries to cover his ass after the fact to not great success sometimes. Yep. But he said he wanted the time, and that they just said every summer weekend we miss, we're flushing millions of dollars down the toilet. And this is when, you know, it's summer movies. That's what it was. And I know to a degree that's still true, but it's definitely changed. But this was just that time. I mean, Jurassic Park is a quintessential summer blockbuster, right? And they were in the tent. You know, this was a tent pole. This is what they're going for. And, you know, what you said about Schwarzenegger taking this one hard, I mean, he really believed in it, and people believed in him. And, you know, he bragged about setting personal records for how many interviews, TV interviews and print interviews he did. Like, he was just, he was all in on this. The studio was all in on this. And it just happened to be kind of a perfect storm of just every once in a while, there's years in movies that, are just stacked. I mean, 95 comes up pretty soon too. It's a different kind of stacked, but it has a lot going for it. What's the Ghostbusters year? That's another big crazy one too, 85. Right? 85.
Yeah. It's that and Back to the Future and probably a bunch of other stuff I'm forgetting.
Yeah, and it just happens sometimes. And
yeah,
maybe as I said earlier, there's a couple what ifs that I don't think are far off from making this a significantly different movie that has a different space and cultural history. But you know, you can put four Oscar winners and six Oscar nominees in a crazy action movie and pour money all over it, and sometimes it doesn't happen.
Yeah, exactly. I was reading a like sort of summer preview in the LA Times, like summer of 1993 preview in the LA Times. And this is a quote from Tom Chirac, who is the head of, or 20th Century Fox executive vice president at the time. It's probably the most crowded summer I could ever remember. If these movies live up to their potential, some of them have to get hurt. It's impossible to shoehorn all these films on first run success. It will be the bloodiest summer since Little Big Horn. And I mean, obviously over the top at the end, but you know, he was right. Some of them got hurt. And I will point out, I looked up Cliffhanger. Cliffhanger was a success. So, I mean, we could also point to that. That is just like, people had their beefcake movie of the summer, and that movie was Cliffhanger. Yeah,
starring former Terminator Sylvester Stallone.
Exactly. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.